I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. The new drama, The Divide, that airs on WeTV is set in Philadelphia and explores the reverberations of a death penalty case. A family is brutally murdered, two men are convicted, and one of them faces execution. A group called the Innocence Initiative and a caseworker named Christine Rosa, played by Maren Ireland, takes up the case. The Divide has been praised for taking on challenging issues like the death penalty, race, class, and justice, with complicated characters as well as a top-notch cast. The Divide's creators were inspired by the work of the real-life Innocence Project. It was filmed here in Philadelphia. The third episode aired this week, and we wanted to know more about this drama series and asked Richard LaGravenais to join us. He's a veteran screenwriter and director. His previous work includes The Fisher King, film adaptations of The Bridges of Madison County and The Horse Whisperer, as well as the Liberace biopic on HBO called Behind the Candelabra. And he joins us from NPR Studios in New York. And Richard LaGravenais, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much, Marty.
You're very welcome. Also with us is Marissa Bluestein, legal director of the Pennsylvania Innocence Project, and she was a consultant to the writers and producers of The Divide. And Marissa, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. Richard, if I could begin with you, and just even looking at all the work that you have done in your careers as a screenwriter, a producer, and even director, what got you interested in this particular topic?
It began with my friendship with Tony Goldwyn, and Tony had done a film called Conviction, which was the true story of Betty Ann Waters, who was a woman who put herself through law school for 17 years with the sole purpose of exonerating her brother, who had been falsely accused of murder. And she succeeded in doing that with the help of the Innocence Project. After he had done that film and had gotten to know Peter Neufeld and Barry Sheck of the New York Innocence Project, he wanted to continue exploring that story. And we were talking about a TV series. And after months of coming up with character and story and wanting to write about the time that we live in now, we came up with The Divide.
And you chose Philadelphia as a place to place your story. Why Philadelphia?
Well, a number of reasons. We needed a state that had the death penalty. We're both New Yorkers, and actually we started doing the show before Tony became the president in Scandal. So he wasn't in L.A. as much. He was in New
York.
He's
a busy guy, yes.
Yeah, so we wanted to stay closer to New York, closer to home, and shoot in Philadelphia. Just for a freshness, I remember thinking and talking to him, we hadn't seen a TV show set in Philadelphia in a while. We wanted to do someplace new that we hadn't seen visually.
And Marissa, you've been a consultant to this this project. What got you interested in The Divide?
Hi, Marissa.
Hi, Richie. It's nice to hear you.
We're all sort of connected here by pipes and tubes. Yeah, go ahead, Marissa.
Hello, Marissa.
Well, I was lucky enough to have been contacted by Maddie Delone, who is the executive director of the Innocence Project in New York. And remember, there are about 60 Innocence organizations around the country, Innocence Project being the largest one, and she said they're doing this project set here in Philadelphia. Would you be willing to talk to the writers and the producers about the procedure involved in what you do and that kind of stuff? And I said, of course, I'd be happy to do that. And so I had some very interesting long conversations with some of the writers about the procedures that are involved in Pennsylvania, some involving the death penalty, but more involving DNA access and things about post-conviction relief. So that's pretty much how that started
Sure.
a couple years ago.
And Richard, what did you want to know from Marissa?
procedures and how people feel about this. You know, what strikes me the most when I spend time with Marissa is the dedication and how it affects their lives. She told me once that you never sleep when you work for when you have clients who are innocent, and there's something really powerful about that. So a lot of it was about character stuff, but also about the technicalities of, all right, if this happened in the court or this happened with the DNA, what would be the next step? And, we'd get that kind of procedure stuff.
Well, in many ways, it revolves around Christine Rosa, as I said in my intro, played by Maren Ireland, and she's a caseworker. She works for this Innocence Initiative in Philadelphia, and dedicated probably isn't a strong enough word to describe her approach to this case. Obsessed, exactly. Why was it important to tell this, I guess, in many ways through her life and experience, Richard?
Because we wanted to we wanted to, for me, it's all about character. The justice system, the death penalty, the Innocence Initiative, these are all, this is the world, the arena that we are placing the characters. But for instance, a death penalty conviction, how does it affect the people, the periphery people? How does it affect the family of those who are in death row? It has a ripple effect. How does it affect the victims of the people who are convicted of the crime? So we wanted to sort of spread out and explore those areas.
Do you want to add to that, Marissa? I mean, in many ways, as you were describing to me, you've got law students, you know, that work with the Innocence Project here in Pennsylvania. I mean, they are, in many ways, I guess, your Christine Roses, yes?
Well, luckily, our students have a little more boundaries than Christine does. And we have a lot of discussions about ethics and what they can and cannot do out in the field and with clients, many of which generated by the show.
Yes, I'm sure. But we will ask about that, but go ahead, Marissa.
But they certainly do come to us with a sense of wanting to right these terrible wrongs and that this is a way to do that. Or we also get a lot of students who come with us who want to be prosecutors, but they're looking at this to want to make sure they get a full view of the system so they're not part of, you know, contributing to these wrongs, however inadvertently that may be done in real life. They're getting a very well-rounded picture of that. So they come with this with some different motivations sometimes.
Richard, I should tell you that Marissa and I were talking about a scene in the opening, I guess, pilot where Christine Rosa goes to prison and undoes her shirt.
Yeah.
Shows one of the people facing the death penalty her bra. And Marissa and I were talking about whether that would happen in real life or not. And I'm just curious about why you had her do that.
Look, we're not doing a documentary. We were trying to tell a story. And it felt, I wanted to show how far Christine would go. That I wanted to show that Christine is a unique character and a tough character. When she has a goal in mind, she'll go anywhere. What's great about that scene for me is the way she controls it, because once he sees it and she mentions his mother, she knows exactly that his sexual interest is going to be completely cut off. And so she's in control the whole time, really. And I liked that about her. It made her a strong woman to me.
And how did you, Marissa, and your staffers talk about that scene?
Well, it did make for very interesting discussion with my interns the next day about the boundaries that we have as lawyers, both ethically and morally, in terms of working with other clients. Of course, as lawyers, we're very bound by the rules of professional conduct. And there are certain things that lawyers can and cannot do. You can't misrepresent yourself. You can't lie. You can't do things that are on the line, shall we say. So we take a very strict rule with those rules, and we teach the students, no, you stay pretty far away from that line. So Richie did help us with the discussion, so I appreciate that.
And remember, Christine is not a lawyer yet.
No,
she actually doesn't like the law. She's only studying law because she has to, but she, you know, she and her family, she feels, has been hurt by the law and not given justice. So she doesn't have a lot of faith in the law, which is why she's an interesting character to me.
In fact, let me play a scene, and this is a caseworker, Christine Rosa. She's portrayed by Maren Ireland, and she's describing for an intern the kinds of cases that their Innocence Initiative can take on. She expresses her suspicion of the criminal justice system, and it's tempered by the organization's leader, portrayed by Paul Schneider in this TV series we're talking about called The Divide. Let's listen.
But I don't understand why we didn't take his case.
Why?
I believe his story. He said he was in a relationship with a girl, that it wasn't rape.
Okay, look, you're not focusing on the information that matters. It's not about whether or not you believe their story. We get thousands of letters. It is easier to get into Harvard than to get us to accept a case. We say yes only if we can rewrite a narrative that questions the prosecutor's case, and only if the science can answer that question with a DNA component. We're training ourselves to find what we don't know. Prosecutors, police can make mistakes, but they also take liberties to make cases.
Not all of them, not all the time.
They manipulate witnesses, they suppress, even manufacture evidence, and they get away with it.
Not all of them, not all the time.
And again, a scene from The Divide. Richard, I'm assuming you wrote that scene?
Yes, but a couple of those lines were directly from people who work in the Innocence Project. Marin took time to spend time at the Innocence Project and work with them and became friends with a couple of the people there, Bryce and I think Vanessa. And at times she would call them when the scripts would come in, and the line about Harvard and that explanation all came from them.
Mm-hmm. And do you at the Innocence Project or the Pennsylvania Innocence Project, Marissa, do you get thousands of letters every year?
We do. Well, not every year, but we have gotten thousands of letters. And for us, I think I disagree with Marin's character a bit, because for us it is about whether or not we believe the story. And since we don't just take DNA cases, and we're looking at cases of pretty complex narratives that we're looking at, what we're really looking about is seeking the truth. I mean, in terms of what happened, what were the facts, what are the actual facts, did it go the right way, did it go the wrong way? So from our perspective, it is a little bit more about, you know, is this person innocent or not, and trying to make that determination based on the very limited information we get.
And I'm assuming, and we see in this series, you know, looking through documents and records and photographs, I mean, is that how, as an organization, you determine whether someone is a case you want to take on?
It determines on whether or not it's a case we want to take on, exactly. And in fact, my students who should be listening right now are engaged in exactly that. They're going through the trial transcripts, going through the medical examiner reports. It's a little bit difficult in Pennsylvania just because we don't have access to the information that the prosecutor has or the police have. We can't get it in any context in the post. So we're looking at a very spotty record. But looking at that record nonetheless, there's still some patterns that evolve: eyewitness misidentifications, potential false confessions, bad science. And once we decide that this is a case that we can spend our resources on, that's when we'll start investigating or talking to people.
Richard, I'm curious about how much time you spend. I mean, the sort of homework, I guess, that goes into creating a show like this, which is complicated. I mean, it is a kind of fallout from this horrible murder and how it affects sort of everybody that's in this particular orbit, about a minute before our first break here. But what's the kind of homework that goes into that for you?
Well, there's a lot of research and questions that get asked. I reduce everything to character, and then from there, whatever I need, I ask questions about. And then I look at the current events of the world that we're living in, and try and take from that. That's the simplest answer I can give with a minute to go.
Yeah, and we still have a little more time before the break there. But, I mean, do you feel like you have to, I mean, talk to someone like Marissa, lawyers and people,
yes,
to give
absolutely.
You that the sort of the right
yes.
kind of language to use in a courtroom?
Yes, there's another lawyer, Mark Bookman, who's also an amazing lawyer and very dedicated. And he's someone who would read all the scripts and give us the right language and say a lawyer wouldn't do this and this wouldn't mean anything. Sometimes I would go for a dramatic moment and he would say, well, technically that really wouldn't be that dramatic because it wouldn't happen. And so he kept me on track quite a bit.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation talking with Richard LaGravenace and Maria Bluestein about a series that airs on WeTV. It's called The Divide. It happens to be filmed here in Philadelphia, or was filmed here in Philadelphia, and involves a caseworker who works for an organization called the Innocence Initiative, and a murder and the fallout of a murder and people on death row, people facing life in prison. And again, taking a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back.
Flashpoint Theater supports WHYY and presents Herringbone now through July 27th, starring 10-time Barrymore nominee Ben Dibble. George Herringbone is a unique kind of vaudeville star with the looks, the voice, and the moves. He also has a little help, which is more than he bargained for. Herringbone is a harrowing musical ghost story that explores the true price of fame. Tickets at flashpointtheater.org and 267-997-3312. Flashpoint Theater proudly supports WHYY.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Usually comics start out doing open mics in comedy clubs. Hori Kondabolu started out doing progressive political jokes in Seattle. So they literally did not know how to laugh.
There's good things in that, like I have a unique audience. You also deal with folks who don't know how comedy clubs work, so they will snap.
Hori Kondabolu on the next Bullseye from NPR.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. A former mill town in North Carolina reinvents itself as a biomedical research hub, with many residents serving as study subjects.
This data and information and blood that people are contributing is extremely valuable, and it will also be connected to them and future generations.
We'll look at the economics and ethics behind this next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. We are talking about a new WE TV drama called The Divide. And the creators, Richard LaGravenese, who's our guest in this hour of Radio Times, along with Tony Goldwyn, explore issues that have been in the news recently, including the death penalty, racial tensions, the justice system. The show was filmed in Philadelphia. And let me play another scene from The Divide. And this is from a recent episode that aired this week. Jenny Butler describes how she feels as the lone survivor of a crime that left her entire family dead. She's consoled by the young son of the prosecutor that represented her. Let's listen.
It's the way people look at me sometimes. It's like if you were in some terrible accident and they put all these bandages on you and people would be able to see where you were broken. They'd write their names on your cast and stuff. And when you got better, the casts and bandages would come off and you'd be yourself again. When people look at me, all they see is someone who will always be broken up inside.
I don't see that.
No? What do you see?
I see a woman in a cold storm who's still filled with love and strength and is warm. So next to you, as I take a seat, I'm gonna sit back while I bask in the heat coming from the words that you speak. You're the furthest thing from weak. I see the pain that you own but don't wanna keep. I see it's a heart like yours that everybody seeks. Your tolerance for pain is something I have yet to gain. I don't know what to say. Bad things happen to good people, and that's just a part of the game. Because you could prove it, and nobody knows how you do it. Because we don't get over some things, but I see you get through it. So don't lose it. Don't weep. Let's just bask in the heat.
And again, another scene from The Divide. I should add Jenny Butler, played by Brittany Oldford. And if I can go back to you, Richard LaGravenese, she's obviously a very important character in this story. She witnessed the brutal murder of her family. She believes as a young child that she identified the perpetrators. But as time goes on, we begin to see that that falls apart. Help us understand this character.
This is inspired by a case I saw in a documentary called After Innocence, which is about people who were wrongfully convicted and coming out of prison. And I saw a scene where a woman who was raped identified her attacker three separate times, and he spent 12 years in prison. And she was wrong. And on camera, she apologized to him. And it was a stunning moment to see the way he accepted her apology, this benign quality he had. Anyway, misidentification is a key thing that Marissa and others at the Institute tell us is often the case in wrongful convictions. And again, we wanted to explore the ripple effect that convictions and crimes have on the people who survive them.
Let me go back to you, Mercer. We've actually done a couple of shows about eyewitness testimony and why it can be so unreliable. Help us understand sort of where we are in understanding how eyewitness testimony either can or can't work.
Right. I mean, I think one of the important things to remember is that it's not that all eyewitnesses get it wrong or all eyewitnesses are inaccurate. That's not at all what the message is. The message is that sometimes human memory can make an unreliable or inaccurate identification later. So the answer to that is we revise the way that we are asking witnesses to make identifications of strangers. And that is through what we call photo arrays, where the witness is shown pictures of potential suspects, or through live lineups. And so we know from studying human memory for over 30 years that there are particular ways to do this that can help preserve that memory as it is. We almost like it's a crime scene in and of itself, as odd as that may sound. And so by using these better procedures, more scientifically based methods, we believe that we can actually preserve that memory better and try to get the most reliable, accurate evidence that we can from that memory.
And get away from the kind of leading, whether conscious or unconscious, probably leading type questions.
And that's the issue. It's not about, you know, is it the police officer or prosecutor is trying to get the, of course not. It's about that it is this subconscious cueing, which we know maybe the officer leans in a little bit more, maybe the breathing starts a little bit faster. When they get to number three, maybe there's like kind of a connection
body language with the or something.
And every detective I've talked to will tell you the same thing, that if they make an identification, the first thing they do is look up. Like, did I get it right? And for the detective, it's very natural to say, yeah, that's the guy we were looking at. And yet we know that's very problematic in terms of the memory. So the easiest fix is the person running the identification doesn't know who the suspect is, so they can't give that confirmatory feedback. And that's probably the biggest reform that we're looking at.
Richard, yeah, did you want to add something?
Okay. No,
I just heard you breathe there. Now, let me ask you, though, a bit about this Jenny Butler. She's now, I guess, a teenager. She witnessed, as I said, this brutal murder of her family, and she is in therapy. She's in an interesting form of therapy. Talk about that a bit.
It's called flooding, which is a behavioral technique that a member of my family went through after 9/11. And it's a real effective process where you're taken through the steps of the trauma in order to get past them. And you have it's very specific. It's not about telling what happened. It's about what you're doing in that moment. For example, you don't say, well, I got off the bus and I saw this. You say, no. You go back and say, okay, I'm stepping off the bus. Mm. I look up. I see this. And suddenly little windows of memory that were blocked are opened and you get to experience them and feel them and then move past them. And that was based on.
And I think something I heard you say was that you had a sister who sounds like was traumatized after September 11th.
Yes, she was at 9/11. She's still, thank God, but you know, suffered post-traumatic stress. And she was in building 2 when the hit. She was a nurse for Merrill Lynch and was doing sort of regular corporate nursing stuff. And because she was a nurse, she had to lead people from the building to safety when everything was happening. And, you know, it wasn't until she did the flooding, actually, that she had a memory of hearing the buildings fall, because she was only 2 blocks away doing a triage when that happened. And this therapy really helped her move through it. It was very effective.
And obviously very traumatizing, but as you said, right, effective. And I guess one of the things that you wanted to include this series is maybe to help us understand how this kind of therapy works.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Let me reintroduce the two of you. That's Richard LaGravenais, and he is a screenwriter. He's a director. He's the executive producer and writer for this new show that we've been talking about. It's on the WeTV channel. It's called The Divide, and it's filmed here in Philadelphia, and features an organization here in Philadelphia called the Innocence Initiative in The Divide. And also with us is Marissa Bluestein, and she's legal director for the Pennsylvania Innocence Project, was a consultant to the writers and producers of The Divide. And if you have any questions or comments to join our conversation, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. And again, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Richard, I don't think I'm giving too much away because it's already aired, but one of the men convicted is executed in this series. We see it. We witness it. And I have to say, it's very antiseptic. And I'm curious about, first of all, why you wanted to include that.
Well, for dramatic purposes, it was a surprise mislead that was very effective, because Chris Bauer is a very well-known actor on television, and to lose him midway through the second episode heightened the stakes. We also wanted just to show what that's like. It was a tough scene to shoot for the actors to witness. I mean, Brittany was just telling me the other night how difficult that was for her to sit there and watch that. We don't often see the effects of all of that. And in the research that came up, it's amazing to me how with Arizona and Oklahoma recently, you know, we started I was writing this during the winter, and then these things happened that were coming true that we had just researched, you know, where prisons are using cocktails that haven't been regulated, and these awful things are happening during executions. The synchronicity of that was kind of surprising.
Well, I have to say, as I was watching it this week, I was thinking about Joseph Rudolph Wood. He was executed, I believe it took about 2 hours, Marissa, for him to die in Arizona. It's raised a whole host of questions about these cocktails, as Richard described, and also just this long process, I guess, of what it is to put someone to death.
That's true. And in fact, one of the kind of side issues that have been released with the Wood case, it was focusing on the Ninth Circuit opinion. So there was a Ninth Circuit opinion which said that there was a First Amendment right for Mr. Wood to know what he was going to be injected with and how he was going to be killed, what the qualifications of the people who were doing it, et cetera. But Judge Kaczynski, in a dissent in a further matter, actually took on that word that you just used, the antisepticness of this, and said that we should go back to firing squads, because that we, by using the lethal injections that we use, it takes away, as he said, the brutality. Mm. Now, this is from a man who supports the death penalty.
Yes.
So, right,
yes,
Judge Kaczynski is a very conservative judge. There's no question about his support of the death penalty as an available sentence. But his point was, we've made it too antiseptic and too private. This should be a public matter. And, in fact, talks about guillotines and firing squads and saying there's no mistake in a bullet. Let's go back to the firing squad. So he kind of took that on head-on in his dissent from that particular part of the ruling.
But do you think we could also take away from that, which is, let's, you know, if people support the death penalty, many people do, let's get it out in the open and let's see what it is that the state does in our name?
That's exactly what the judge was saying. That's precisely what he was saying, is that let's not fool ourselves about this. This is a brutal process. We want people to see it. This is what it's all about. So that's part of what the discussion is right now.
Richard, is your show a anti-death penalty show?
No, I don't want it to be. I don't want to impose any specific ideas, but rather just raise questions and discussion, mostly. It's important not to create things that are important with your intention of this is important. It's really just about storytelling. And I have mixed feelings, you know, so I would like to keep it balanced and open as much as possible.
Well, and what we see, and I'm back to you, Marissa, what we see too, and I think this is true for just about all death penalty cases, is that they take years to conclude one way or the other. The appeals process goes on for years. You think about the families of the victims, for instance, in a murder case or something like that, which is, if they want justice, you know, do you get justice 25 years later, or do you never get the justice that you're looking for?
Of course, and that has to be considered. There's no question that we have to consider the victims' families and how they feel about this. But remember, the National Academy of Sciences just a few weeks ago put out a report saying that from their findings and the reviewings of death penalty cases, potentially 4% of death penalty inmates are actually innocent of their crimes. So notwithstanding the fact that these appeals take a very long time, there may be very well be people who are innocent who have been executed at the state, and another hundreds potentially who are on death row right now who did not commit the crime. So time is necessary sometimes for these cases to be fully examined. We don't get that same kind of sense at leading up to trial. And of course, you have to consider things like the qualifications of the lawyers who are trying these cases. Are they fully qualified? Do they have the resources they need to do these? Mm-hmm. So there's a whole host of issues, particularly for indigent defense and indigent defense funding, that comes up with these issues. But I think that we can't divorce that innocence, you know, specter from these questions, even notwithstanding the fact that, of course, these victims need to be nurtured better through the system, no doubt about it.
Yeah, go ahead, Richard.
And as long as there is that that flaw in the system, it raises the question, should we even have the death penalty until if one innocent person falls through the system, then, you know, you have to question whether or not that's right. It's a state of mind in this country that I don't quite understand. It's easy to morally say that. However, if I were affected by a crime, I don't know emotionally if I would feel the same way. That's why I say I have mixed, you know, feelings about it. But you know, intellectually and morally, yes. As long as one innocent person falls through the system, we should reevaluate this and put a hold on everything. But Marissa, let me ask you something though, because in the show, Jared dies and we find out that he didn't commit the murders. However, if he were in the house while the murders were happening and didn't stop them, according to Pennsylvania law, a jury could still impose a death penalty on him for that. Is that correct?
I honestly am not. This is where you would need Mark for this.
I mean, he's okay, definitely. Okay, I think that's what I was told. But, I mean, it still would be a judgment call, but it's not a fait accompli. But.
It's certainly something that the jury would take into consideration, as far as I understand, and kind of weigh that as a factor. And many states have this prohibition against, unless you were actually the one who did the murder, you cannot get the death penalty. Uh-huh. So there is some states do draw that line. And that's certainly something that is worth considering. But certainly it's true that if he was in the house and he did not prevent it and he was an active participant, he's a conspirator and he's on the hook for everything that occurs in that house. What the sentence is and what the penalty is a different question. But in terms of his culpability, the way that it's set out in the show, there's really no doubt that he is almost equally culpable as whoever it was.
He's not entirely innocent, is what we're saying. Exactly. Right.
Well, and it seems like the series looks at people's complicated, in certain ways, flawed lives. You also, that's Richard, look at this through a sort of a racial lens, even though the prosecutor says this is not a case about race, but these are the stereotypes that I think it challenges, which is the victims, the family murdered are black professionals. They live in a white neighborhood. The people convicted are white people from a working class neighborhood. Even the caseworker is a kind of white working class woman herself. Were you, though, interested in kind of turning some of these racial issues on their head?
Yes, very much. Initially, we had the races reversed. And actually, it was Barry Scheck's idea to flip them because it opened up an arena and it also made it more current to discuss what some journalists are calling this post-racial Obama period that we're in and the contradictions and hypocrisy of that. And so it made it more interesting to do that. Mm.
I'm curious about.
And the race issue will become clearer as it goes on. Now he's saying that it wasn't about race for him, but you'll see by episode 6, you'll see those issues get raised because his father, the police commissioner, came from a different time and has a different point of view about race than his son does. And both Clark Peters and Damon Gumpton, who play those characters as black actors, said to us they were thrilled that they were able to play scenes about race that they don't usually get to play.
Can I say how happy I was to see Clark Peters? Because I loved him in The Wire. I loved him in Tremé.
He's the best.
He is. I mean, he's just as an actor and as someone who loves good TV. It's really nice.
Right now,
to
he's
see
in Central Park doing King Lear. He's wonderful. Yeah.
Oh, and I'm curious about just even the casting for this show. I mean, what you were looking for? Did you get the actors that you wanted?
Very much, yeah. I mean, really strong actors, and we had a lot of support from the network that they were not interested in stars. They're interested in creating stars. So it wasn't about names. It was just about talent. And, I may proudly say that a lot of them are really strong theater actors.
Is it weird to be, though, on WeTV, which also carries Bridezilla and some of these other reality shows? Is it sort of an odd neighborhood to be in?
They approached us with the idea, television right now is expanding the terrain. It's like the Wild West. Whoever thought that Netflix would be a viable television programming? And before The Shield, I had never watched FX, and before Mad Men, I hadn't watched AMC. So this idea of rebranding and is common. So we were excited about the newness of that, and hopefully, it will find its audience.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. That's Richard LaGravenaise. He's a screenwriter and director. His previous work includes the Fisher King film adaptations of The Bridges of Madison County, The Horse Whisperer, and the Liberace biopic on HBO called Behind the Candelabra. He's the co-creator of WeTV's The Divide, debuted last week. He also serves as executive producer and writer for the show. And also with us, Marissa Bluestein, and she's legal director for the Pennsylvania Innocence Project and was a consultant to the writers and producers of The Divide. And we want to hear from you, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Open Sky Energy, a solar energy company, supports WHYY. Open Sky Energy helps homeowners and businesses explore whether solar is the right investment in a relaxed and informative way. More at openskyenergy.net.
On the next Fresh Air, as Project Runway begins its new season, we feature our interview with Tim Gunn. Although he's now a confident mentor, he had a difficult adolescence. He stuttered, he was in denial about being gay, and he was bullied. When he was 17, he tried to kill himself. We'll talk about his life and, of course, about fashion. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
For Richard Nixon, secrecy was king.
All files, any correspondence or anything that has to do with between me and any member of my staff belongs to the president, not to them.
Almost 40 years since the president's resignation, a look at the tapes he protected until his death. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Holman Cadillac proudly supports WHYY. During Holman Cadillac Summer's Best event, over 200 of the season's collection of new and pre-owned Cadillacs are available for a test drive. More at Holman Cadillac on Route 73 in Mount Laurel, New Jersey, and online at holmancadillac.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Richard LeGravenes and Marissa Bluestein about The Divide. And this is the new WeTV drama that aired last week on WeTV. And let me play another scene from the series. Death row inmate Jared Benkowski, portrayed by Chris Bauer, speaks with his mother, portrayed by Ann Dowd. And this is before he is executed. Let's listen.
You look good.
Thanks. I already ordered my last meal. You know what I ordered?
No. I don't want to know that.
Hot dogs. They got the same ones in here you used to buy. Couldn't believe they still make them. I don't think there's any real meat in those. Remember I used to beg you to buy the fancy ones, like on TV?
Yeah, I remember. But they were too expensive. Well, it's all the same anyway. Just the packaging.
Ones you used to buy were like gray colored.
Well, you could have gotten them now. You should have ordered the fancy ones.
Well, I don't want to acquire a taste for the finer things at this late date.
I've been hearing all kinds of things on the news. I don't understand about that DNA.
They're retesting it. Check if they got the right guy.
Do you think there's a chance?
No, Ma. It's not going to change anything for me.
Oh. Oh, yeah. So you're still blaming me for all this, huh? I made all this happen.
No, Ma, I don't blame nobody.
I made you a criminal. Huh? I made you steal and scam and try to make money without ever working and try to be the big shot with that scum you hung out with. I did all that, didn't I? You broke my heart for a long time.
Well, it took that long to find it.
You did this to yourself.
And again, another scene from The Divide. Richard LeGravenes, it's a very powerful scene, even just listening to it.
Yeah, thank you.
I mean, it begins with hot dogs and ends with her blaming him, basically saying you did, or saying to him, you did this to yourself.
Mm-hmm. That scene is purely character about a mother and son and trying to explain a backstory by not talking about it and implying through what I'm not writing and what they're not saying the dynamic between the two characters. They did it so beautifully, those two actors.
Yeah, I was going to say Ann Dowd and Chris Bauer. I mean, there was mm-hmm. there was real sort of chemistry between the two of them.
Very
as
much.
They were doing
yeah.
the scene.
Yeah.
Do you know, was that a lot of takes or... Do you know?
No, they knew. They came on the floor knowing exactly what to do, and Tony did a great job of directing it. So it was just a handful of takes, and they nailed it.
Wow. Let me get, looks like Shauna from Los Angeles to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Shauna. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
I was just calling to say good morning to Richard and Marissa, and I've been watching the show and love it.
Hi, Shauna.
Who are you? You have to tell us who you are because clearly our guests know, but Shauna, we do not. Go, who are you?
I was the prior investigator for the Pennsylvania Innocence Project, and I was there for about 3 years.
Oh, Shauna.
Yes.
Hello. Hi.
Good morning.
We were just talking about you the other night.
You were doing a wonderful job with the show, and I love watching the first couple episodes.
Great. That's great. Thank you, Shauna.
Yeah, thank you.
That means a lot.
Of course.
Thanks for calling in.
Yeah, if Christine has half the stick-to-itiveness that Shauna has, then
oh my God.
We should be just fine.
Is Christine a base in part on Shauna?
Shauna's definitely an inspiration for Christine.
Oh, that's great. That's good to know. Shauna,
I
appreciate the call to Radio Times. Richard, even going back to you, I thought the season opens with a quote from Nietzsche. I thought, you know, you don't normally see that on TV. The third episode begins with a quote from Cervantes, "Facts are the enemy of truth." I thought that was kind of bold to begin with those very philosophical, deep quotes.
Thank you.
Was that important?
It was, yeah, to me, it gave it context a little bit. Literally, I was looking for quotations that had the word divide in them initially. And I found that, and that seemed to explain the theme of the series mm-hmm. really well. And then it became a nice way to open up each one. And we don't always use fancy literary figures or philosophers. We try and do a number of different quotes.
Marissa, we have a couple emails here, including one from Sean says, please explain the statement by one of the guests, that would be you, that defense attorneys do not have access to all the information that prosecutors and police have. Could they withhold information to the disadvantage of the defendant?
Well, the issue that we face is really not so much in the pretrial, but in the post-trial context. So what we're looking at are cases that are sometimes decades old. So we're having to reconstruct. And once a person has been convicted of a crime, then getting additional information is very limited in Pennsylvania. And it's not unique, but we're one of a very small number of states that has so difficult. Mm-hmm. For example, in many states, by filing a Freedom of Information Act or Right to Know request, inmates can get access to the redacted versions of police reports and other things that were used in the prosecution, not in Pennsylvania. That's exclusively, it is specifically not included in the Right to Know laws. It's excluded, in fact, anything to do with a criminal investigation. Nor are they entitled to any form of discovery post-conviction. So they're not get that. So either you have it because your defense lawyer had it and then you've kept it, or you don't. But we have inmates who've been transferred through, you know, many times over the process, and they don't have it. The lawyers are only required to keep their records for 7 years, so they may have destroyed it. So much of what we have to do is this kind of piecemeal back together. And since we're so small, I mean, we are a very, very small organization with only, you know, three essentially full-time staff members who do the actual work, it's incredibly difficult for us to put it back together, especially with a state this big.
But how do you put a case back together that's, say, 25 years old? I mean, that seems impossible
it
to me.
It is nearly impossible. But we have the law students who are working with us. They're very good about trying to work with the past lawyers, work with the inmates. Maybe the inmate's family has some information. Sometimes the district attorney or prosecutors or police will share information with us that they're not required to. They absolutely do not have to under the law. In fact, the law protects them from doing so, but sometimes we get that because they too want to get to the truth. It's like the Nietzsche quote
right.
On our wall. It's not Nietzsche, it's actually Bill Bradley, which is the truth emerges, that we have from, you know, the Washington Post state. So that's part of where Ben Bradley, excuse me.
I was going to say Bill Bradley, really?
No, Ben Bradley. So that's on our wall, the truth emerges. And that's really what we believe, that when we're going after these facts, that the truth will emerge. It just takes a while for us sometimes.
I mean, this case in many ways revolves around DNA evidence, and a lot of these cases do seem to revolve, real-life cases revolve around that. But how often do you, I'm thinking about what you do in Pennsylvania, how often do you actually have DNA?
Very rarely. DNA is only available in maybe 12% of all serious felony cases at all to begin with. So of our cases, we're litigating, I think, 19 across the Commonwealth, only five involved DNA. I actually kind of joke with our colleagues at Innocence Project New York that they have it a little easier because it's with the DNA. We're the ones who have to actually, we go out and we talk to witnesses. It's not easier, but it's a little bit different viewpoint because we have to go back and read and talk to witnesses, see what happened. Is there additional information that didn't come forward before that should have? And really try to see about how this jigsaw puzzle actually does fit together.
Richard, if I can go back to you, and I'm just curious about, because you are a screenwriter, just what it's like to write for TV, for instance.
It's a great experience because you're allowed to give breath to character and to story. And it's the easiest way to explain it is that writing for television is more like writing a novel, and writing for film is more like writing a short story.
In that TV gives you time to explore and develop
and
characters.
It's a living, breathing thing. So as you're creating it and writing it, it becomes its own entity, and you find, oh, this is an interesting character. I didn't plan on being interesting, but I'd like to know more about this character. So you can do that. You can shift focus. You can follow the lead of this living, breathing creation that you have, which is a really great experience.
And are you on the set writing and rewriting? I mean, as it's being filmed?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Writing the next week's episode and working with the actors on this week. And because we had such smart actors, it was a really great experience. The partnership was really respectful and very supportive.
And are you surprised that TV has, I mean, forget Bridezilla, but the TV, I mean, TV, there's so much good TV these days. And does that surprise you?
No, not at all, because television is a writer's medium, and film is more of a director's medium. So good writers have gravitated to television to write their ideas and their stories. And audiences are responding with all the new technology, and there's so many different ways of them following a story that it's just expanded.
Let me get, looks like Rich from Long Court to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Rich, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you. Richard, enjoy the show very much.
Thank you.
I have a question for Marissa.
Sure.
Marissa, with the advent of DA, we now know for certain that mistakes have been made in the criminal justice system. And we also see that there are conviction integrity units that have been developed around the country in Dallas and California and Brooklyn and New York and so forth, where DAs have been willing to look at cases and see if mistakes have been made. I'm curious as to what your relationship is with the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office, whether they are open to, number one, agreeing to DNA when it exists, and number two, reviewing files that you bring to them.
Rich, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Marissa, your response.
Well, I think we're a fairly young organization. We've been around for 5 years, and it's going to take us a while to kind of build some credibility with others. But we do have cases with the District Attorney's Office where we haven't had to file for DNA requests, and that's a new phenomenon, and we're very happy about that and working on that. And I think leading up to that was that, for example, in DNA cases where we filed requests for DNA, the request to work on together was not accepted. Instead, we went to court and we litigated these, and in fact, some of them are now on appeal because we won them in the trial court, and now they're on appeal with Superior Court. But it seems to be that is changing somewhat within the District Attorney's Office. So, and as far as the conviction review units, where they've been successful, like in Brooklyn and in Dallas, have been where they've been fully staffed, where there are inset protocols to be able to review, because they do take a lot of time. This isn't just a matter of being able to review. They have to be investigated. They need resources. They need the lawyers. They need the investigators. So there has to be, for this to be a functional unit that truly is invested in looking at righting these terrible wrongs, there has to be that investment up front. And we're hoping that the DA's office does take that into account when they're putting this unit together. To be fair, I think it's probably too early in the process for that, and I'm hoping that they will be looking to Brooklyn and to Dallas in particular to revamp that unit. So we're Brooklyn has freed 7 people just this year.
Wow.
Because the prosecutors went back and looked at these cases they knew to be problematic. But that takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of conviction to be able to do that, and it takes the willingness and the resources to do that. And so we're hopeful that's where we're going to go.
Because I also think what gets lost in this is that if someone is wrongfully convicted, that means that
someone else got away with it.
Someone got away with murder in certain cases.
That's right.
And a threat to society.
That's absolutely correct. And we've seen that in the DNA context. We know that there have been, I think, 60 additional sexual assaults, multiple additional murders convicted because these people went on to do other cases. In case that we've been involved in with Eugene Gilliard and Lance Felder, we know that one of the actual perpetrators went on to commit additional horrific crimes. And in fact, right now is under prosecution for a kidnapping and assault that, you know, had he been prosecuted for the murder, would not have happened.
Richard, going back to you, has anyone made a decision about the second season for The Divide?
Not yet.
When does that happen? I mean, what is the
That's not in my. That's not in my
that's
control.
Not, that's not part of your job description.
We've gotten really, really strong, wonderful reviews that we're very grateful for, and they're now broadcasting it on AMC and the Sundance Channel to expand our audience base, and they're doing everything they can to give it its due. So we'll see.
I was reading that you're working on a new movie, something a film called Unbroken. Do I have that right?
It's done.
Oh, it's done.
I wrote that in 2012. I'm one of other writers. I was the first one to adapt the Laura Hildebrand novel. I met with Louis Zamperini, the late great Louis Zamperini. It's an extraordinary story. I have not seen the film, but I haven't been involved since writing the screenplay back then. But it opens Christmas Day, I think.
Oh, interesting. I mean, it seems that you are someone who takes books and turns them into screenplays. That seems to be one of your areas of expertise.
One of them, yeah. Yeah, well, this was particularly personal to me because my dad was a World War II veteran who was a great athlete like Zamperini and came back kind of a broken man, and so I did it for him.
You did it for him. Oh, wow. So do you have another project that you're working on now?
Right now, well, I have a film that's opening at the Toronto Film Festival called The Last 5 Years with Anna Kendrick, which is a musical that really? I did last year before The Divide started, and very proud of that. It's a very famous off-Broadway musical, well, famous among musical theater fans, by Jason Robert Brown. And it's an indie film, and we're very proud of it, and small movie, and we'll see that release in the fall, I think.
Have you ever done a musical before?
Only as an act. I was a theater major, so I love musicals. This was my first time directing one, and it's a really beautiful love story. It's just a two-character movie.
Well, it's been a great pleasure. Richard LaGravenais, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're very welcome. You're very welcome. Veteran screenwriter, director, and we've been talking about a series on WeTV called The Divide that he is co-creator of, also serves as executive producer and writer for the show. Marissa Bluestein, thank you very much as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And she's legal director for the Pennsylvania Innocence Project and was a consultant to the writers and producers for The Divide. Stay with us here on WHYY, and for more information about the program, go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can check us out on Facebook, you can follow us on Twitter, you can send us an email, and you can find out about the Radio Times newsletter. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back. And do stay with